Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Nintex is the global standard for business process management and automation. The Nintex platform helps their clients accelerate progress on their digital transformation journeys by quickly and easily managing, automating, and optimizing business processes. Learn more at nintex.com.
Blue Lava is the first business platform for CISOs to manage their security program. Blue Lava guides security leaders to effectively measure, optimize, and communicate their security program with confidence and ease in one platform. Learn more at bluelava.net.
No, I'm in the different browser.
Different browser?
Yep.
Is it the browser from the future?
I do not know. It didn't come with a label. It didn't say future, past, I don't know. It's the one that works.
Everything just gets streamed to your brain. That's it. And then your brain freezes.
That's why you have to reboot the brain.
There's always going to be something, right? So maybe if we keep it separated, we can kind of like keep a balancing thing. And if we converge everything in one thing, what if that goes wrong, right?
Yeah.
A single point of failure.
Turn it on and off again. Artificial superintelligence trying to take over the world. There you go. Flick it off. There you go. Okay.
All right. I think
there's always a power switch.
Exactly. I think the audience is already getting the point that we are about to have fun. We are about to talk about the future, which if they know us well enough, they know we like to do that. We like to look at the past, to look at the present, and then trying to see what the future scenarios may be. As a matter of fact, Sean, this is Audio Signals podcast, but we also used to do, and we're bringing it back, I think, right now, the segment that we call the future of the future. So we not only we look in the future, but we look in the future of the future. So Matthew, I hope you're going to help us with that.
We can help you. That's it. Futures.
That's right. And that sounds like money to me.
I don't know. Especially if you're Jeff Bezos. That's it. He needs money for his next space flight. Apparently, it costs $500 million per minute. So I think he needs quite a lot. I think he needs quite a lot for his next space flight.
That's definitely a step in the future that Branson and him, they just took right now. We don't know how is that going to go. But we'll talk about that as well. But Sean, let's go back to a little bit of a standard introduction here, although I like it chaotic like this, so I don't have a problem.
I mean, my brain is already fried from all the thoughts. Just like, well, what's the breakdown of that cost? How much of it is in fuel?
We'll get there.
Yeah, we will get there. All right. Before we do that, though, I'm thrilled to introduce Matthew Griffin, who is, guess what? A futurist.
Yes.
So he's looking at all kinds of stuff and talking about it everywhere. I mean, and including governments around the world and innovators around the world. And I mean, Matthew, you're doing a ton. We've connected with you through our good friends, the Mentor Project, and we're thrilled to have you on Audio Signals today. Thanks for joining us.
No, great to be here. So, thank you very much.
And because clearly I'm not giving a good background for all the stuff you're doing. A few minutes for you to share a few thoughts with our audience so they know who they're hearing on the other end here.
Yeah, okay. So I suppose basically in a nutshell, my name's Matthew Griffin. I'm the CEO and founder of the 311 Institute and the World Futures Forum. So the 311 Institute is a futures and deep futures think tank and advisory. Now, what I mean by that is we look anywhere from the present day to 50 years out. So if you're typically a multinational, you're going to be looking at about the next 20 years. So I work with organizations like Disney, T-Mobile, Arm, Samsung, all the companies that you're typically going to be using right now, basically, to actually record this, listen to this, watch this, and everything else. And the reason why I go between 20 to 50 years out is because if you're a sovereign government, then you typically care about the future of energy, jobs, skills, education, infrastructure, you know, the next general election, you know, all those kinds of funky things. So that's kind of the one side. And I cover all sectors and I look at over 450 emerging technologies, everything from AI to nanotech to brain machine interfaces, you name it, we can have a riot down there. And then I also head up the World Futures Forum, and that's more of a philanthropic organization where we look to bring together really sort of thought leaders and decision makers from around the world, typically G7, G20 prime ministers and ministers and governments, to try to solve the world's greatest challenges. So that's everything from things like education, future of water, future of energy, poverty, things that align really with the United Nations SDG 17 goals. And that's it. That's all I do. And the occasional bit of traveling, that's when there's not the odd pandemic hanging around.
And so you're probably really bored about it, right? With all of those thinking.
I'm going to add another spectrum. I'm going to add another spectrum because there's multiple. I mean, so if that's a stack of stuff, right, and you didn't even list all the things you're doing, I'm sure. Let's flip it on its side. And I'm wondering how much of it is risk-based views versus building sustainable society views versus let's just innovate for the heck of innovating views. Yeah. We want to see what's possible. And there's probably some gray areas in between those different realms as well.
So if you look at the spectrum of, you know, the future from an individual perspective, typically you've got startups that are trying to make the impossible possible. So that's everything, for example, from building vertical farms and transforming and revolutionizing agriculture with things like clean meat, where you take a feather from a chicken, put it into something called a bioreactor. You grow the cells from that feather into chicken nuggets, which you can now buy in Singapore, as well as down from Walmart in the US. And now what you have is you have clean meat without ever having to kill an animal. But it's not plant-based meat. It's actually real meat. So you kind of got those kinds of things. So as I say, you've got startups and entrepreneurs that are trying to do the impossible. And that's before we get anywhere near holograms, tractor beams, lightsabers, and all those kinds of things. And for the audience that's listening, if you want to know whether or not lightsabers are possible, they are. They're called plasma jets. The Chinese have invented one for surgery. So that's actually for robo-surgery, which is a whole other conversation in itself. They're about an inch high, but they are actually, yeah, lightsabers. So we kind of go all the way from that sort of thing, all the way then through to, shall we say, sort of more sort of grandiose schemes. You know, when you have a look at a lot of the sovereign governments, more and more sovereign governments, whether it's the UAE, whether it's the US, whether it's Europe, whether it's Singapore, whether it's China, particularly China on steroids at the moment, they see the future as this land of opportunity that will help them increase their GDPs, increase the livelihoods of their citizens. So, and then really you have everything else in the middle. You know, you've got companies like Microsoft who are sort of innovating future of artificial intelligence, workplace, workforce. You've got Nvidia innovating future of artificial intelligence as well. You've got T-Mobile with 5G. You've got 6G coming off the back of all of that kind of stuff. You've got the space race, as we've sort of been seeing in the press at the minute with Bezos and Virgin Galactic, which is a whole conversation in itself. You've got Elon Musk disrupting the global telecommunications market by sending up 12,000 space satellites into low Earth orbit to blanket the Earth in essentially sort of 4G, 5G type global internet coverage, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's this real sort of wormhole when you get into it. And we're not scratching the surface.
So with all of these already, your head is full of imagination and what can it be, why we don't have flying cars like the Jetson. I like to use that example all the time. But at the same time, I mean, the future doesn't happen in, as you're saying, doesn't happen in one particular field or one particular spot. I mean, we look at the future, it's who we are going to be, right? So we can look at a lot of different things, individual, company, government. Based on your experience, and I'm sure the answer is different depending on who you talk to, but if you had to say, you know, we really need to focus on this, I don't know, 5, 10 things, whatever. You pick the number. I mean, what are really those priority that we should look first?
From a civilization perspective, the first thing you want to do basically is get your education and healthcare systems right. Because if people have to worry about future jobs, future income, and their health, then they're not going to be focused on the bigger picture of innovating and doing other things like solving societal challenges, for example. When you start having a look at things at a sort of more granular level, people really need to get their heads around the speed of change. So we call it exponential rate of change. A simple example of this is if you step back, say, 40 years ago, we didn't have the internet. Now we do. If you step back 10 years ago and have a look at the technologies that we're all using 10 years ago, they're very, very different to what we have today. Similarly, you step forward another 10 years, basically, and those technologies are more capable, they're more powerful, they're more ubiquitous, and they're cheaper. A very good example of that is energy. You know, when we have a look at solar, if you step back 10 years ago, solar panels were typically relatively inefficient. They're about 17% efficient for a silicon solar panel. But we now, thanks to, for example, the US Department of Energy, we've got silicon solar panels that are now 48% efficient in the labs. We've got bacterial solar panels that are 50% efficient, carbon nanotube solar panels, basically, that are now about 80% energy efficient. You know, we've got black silicon solar panels coming through from China, which are 132% energy efficient, which is actually possible. That's a conversation in itself. So what we see, for example, the reason why I sort of pick energy as a good example is we are increasing, in the next 10 years, we will increasingly see the cost of generating electricity fall to zero. Whereas years ago, it would be 20, 30 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, basically, out of Belgium, we're at about 1 cent per kilowatt hour. Out of the UAE, we're at about 0.2 cents per kilowatt hour. So the societal impact, basically, of what happens when energy generation is free is significant. You know, you've got to distribute it and everything else. But nevertheless, you know, what happens, basically, to your business when the cost of generating electricity for your massive industrial plant is essentially zero, or you can make a profit from it from selling it. So the first thing is we've got extreme speed. Secondly, don't think about individual technologies. Think about combinations. You know, if you have a look at your smartphone, it's a great example of what you can do when you combine different powerful technologies together. You've got a better screen, faster chips. Computer chips in phones basically are going to be artificially intelligent powered very, very soon. You've got faster memory, you've got faster communication chips and modems. So, for example, we move from 4G to 5G.
And Matt, I want to pull on this thread a little bit because I was actually going to take you down the system route, if you will. Because in order to achieve all the things we really want to achieve, it has to be powered, has to be connected. Yeah. You have to have the communications. And then all the things that make it possible, and then obviously software and whatnot.
Yeah.
How do we arrive to a point where there is a system? Because you described the phone, right? There's two different models. Yeah. There's the open model for the phone and the closed model. And do we see something closed future and an open future, or how does that break down?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have a look at the open system, so Android, for example, is an open system. Now, when you have a look at the benefits of open systems, Google will push out Android, and then lots of developers can start forking Android, innovating new features, creating new versions of it, and they can start pushing that out. So open ecosystems typically are a very, very good way, basically, to foster new innovation. The closed system, not so much, because like Apple, you are relying basically on one company to come up with all of the innovations and then actually put those into the system, put those into the OS, for example. However, as we increasingly look into the future, the open system, while it allows innovators to innovate new things, new features, new benefits, et cetera, new use cases, inherently, they are less controlled, they're less secure, they are more open to systemic abuse, which is exactly what we see with Android. Whereas the closed system is more controlled because it's procedural based, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So both systems have actually got their place. And inevitably, you know, when we have a look at open systems, this sort of happens. You know, if you have a look at GitHub, if you have a look at Kaggle, if you have a look arguably at sort of Red Hat, what you have is you have a whole variety of different developers coming together to develop an open set of standards for something. Those ecosystems and those communities get bigger and bigger and bigger. The market adoption of their technologies basically improves over time. Basically, and again, their market gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The number of users they have gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then all of a sudden, you end up with very large multinational organizations like Google, Microsoft, and IBM who come in and say, well done on building such a fantastic open source community with hundreds of millions of customers. We will buy this thing from you. You know, so for example, with Red Hat is obviously a fork of Linux that was then sort of, you know, commercialized a little bit, but using a relatively innovative business model, but they swooped in. GitHub, exactly the same thing, you know, where you ended up with a lot of developers producing open source code that could be used by a lot of other developers. Microsoft bought them. Kaggle, machine learning and artificial intelligence development, you know, there. Then you've also got companies like Singularity Network that are trying to actually open source artificial intelligence tools. But because they have a single point of contact, because they're a company that ultimately are trying to build this open ecosystem for future artificial intelligence development, there's nothing stopping a company coming in and saying, we'll give you a couple of billion for your community, and then they walk off with it. So open ecosystems only go so far. And increasingly, as we start seeing particularly the larger enterprise like tech organizations gobble them up, they kind of end up sort of like an amoeba. You know, these open source ecosystems eventually get absorbed by these large sort of public private organizations that then fork them, that then bend them to their own will in a variety of different guises, and all of a sudden it's no longer really open source. So now another community springs up to try to fix that problem, and off we go again, and the cycle repeats.
And do you see different regions around the world favoring, I think I know the answer, but favoring closed over open?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you have a look at the West, you know, the West basically is really basically an increasingly entrepreneurial place to be. As an entrepreneur, basically you can go out, you can create anything, basically, and then if the governments don't like it, I was going to say something rude. If the governments don't like it, you know, it's kind of tough. Yeah, and we've seen that, for example, not just in the open source community. We've seen that with companies like Airbnb and Uber, who went off, built something. The regulators and the governments then came in and said, you can't do that. And they said, we already have tens of millions of customers. What are you going to do? Shut us down? And the governments went, let's actually work together then to regulate you. And at that point, companies like Uber are like, okay, you know, well, that sounds good. You know, let's work hand in glove. But realistically, you know, Uber are wearing the size 12 boot. Now, when you have a look at China, for example, and sort of more autocratic states, when you actually walk around China, basically on the ground, there's a huge amount of innovation. The government basically is spending $1.4 trillion over the next 5 years fostering innovation across a variety of different emerging technology areas like AI, quantum, semiconductors, et cetera, et cetera. And that's compared to the US's $400 billion, by the way, and Europe's $600 billion. So guess who's pumping in a huge amount of money to try to win the future that we talked about earlier? But when you have a look at China, for example, there's all this busyness on the ground from an innovation perspective. And the Chinese government actually accepts that and fosters it to a degree. But when those companies get to a particular size, when they start getting to the point where their influence and power starts affecting the CPC, which is the Communist Ruling Party, just as we saw with Jack Ma, Jack Ma with Alibaba, but also Tencent and other organizations, all of a sudden, the government comes in and says, we're going to split you up. We're going to put these new regulations in place. And unlike the US, where we kind of let the tech giants really just rule the roost, in China, they get trodden on. They get broken up. They get crushed. Billionaires typically end up not being billionaires as they start seeing their share prices fall. The recent DD IPO, for example, was a great example of that, along with the disappearance of Jack Ma for a period of time while he is typically sent away basically to have conversations with a ruling CPC party about his untoward behavior towards the financial regulators in his case. So you do have these two different approaches. You know, when you have a look at China, you've got huge state-sponsored innovation ecosystems being built up. They are very purposeful. They're very focused, and they are focused on beating the US and getting ahead of the US by at least two generations. You know, hypersonic technology is another great example of that, where we're already seeing China two generations ahead of the US in hypersonics. But in the US as well as the West generally, innovation is a little bit more of a messier process. And you can kind of argue basically that that sort of messiness is actually what then spawns some of these larger organizations and some of these weird things that you wouldn't necessarily see springing up elsewhere. I mean, I came across one the other day, basically, that's a big company now. It's a company that produces a sports bag that produces ozone within the bag so your trainers don't smell. I mean, you know, in the West, innovation is quite a messy and chaotic and sort of fun experience. And if you want to, and if you're skilled enough, you can scale these to big companies without too much fear of the government basically actually splitting you apart. And again, you know, when we have a look at the US government's approach to Facebook, when Mark Zuckerberg sat in front of the Senate, everyone said it was like watching Mark Zuckerberg explaining technology to my grandparents. So when you have a look at where the US regulators sit when it comes to their policing and their policy development of new emerging technologies and capabilities and use cases and things, we don't have too much to fear about because, frankly, they have no idea what they're actually looking at or what's coming, which is where I come from.
And if we think that they will make finally, ultimately, the decision, that's kind of scary, as you said. But listen, we could have gone in so many different directions here from talking about gadgets or, you know, health or anything, right? Communication. You went to my favorite field, which is kind of like the future scenario and who is going to win the future. And from a political perspective, and from what you said, it seems to me that policy and government are kind of the one that may be the one deciding who wins. So China, you said, is investing so much, they have a plan. And here we let the economy decide and it's kind of like scattered. So if I had to bet money on someone right now, maybe, I don't know, not that I want to, but I would see like a little bit of a plan to help with this. But so my question is, as we look at 50 years from now or the future, and of course, Sean, you know this was coming, is it dystopian or is it a utopian future? Are we being positive about it?
Yeah. So this is where, ironically, the thing that makes the difference between whether you live in a utopia or a dystopia is the government that you are either under or the government you elect. That's it. From a technology, so giving you a couple of examples, basically from a technology perspective, I now have enough emerging technologies, basically where I can surveil everything you do online. We know that already. That's nothing new. I have a whole plethora of technologies that allow me to monitor you offline. If you think about the Alexa speaker that's or the Google speaker that's actually in your kitchen, they can listen to you. They can listen to your voice. Basically, they can tell you when you're getting ill. They can tell you when you're likely to get a heart attack, because when you get ill and when you have a heart attack, your voice box changes. Same with COVID. We can tell via your voice if you have COVID or are getting COVID. We can tell if you have depression, PTSD, or dementia just from your voice. So these surveillance-like technologies are everywhere. I can use artificial intelligence to turn your Wi-Fi, courtesy of MIT, into a sonar-like device that not only tells me exactly where you are in the house, it can tell me how you are walking. Because I can tell how you are walking, it's a little bit like radar and sonar for submarines. Because I can tell what your gait is, how you're walking, I can tell whether or not you are taking your medicine. or whether or not you have postural problems. I can tell your emotions with a 96% accuracy from your Wi-Fi signal. So now think what I could do basically with the CCTV on the street, with the persistent surveillance drones that are 30,000 feet above, I think that one's Chicago or Boston, let alone all these other things. So from a dystopian perspective, when I join all these different systems up, as they actually are and kind of have in China, if you drop litter in China, a camera picks it up, uses facial recognition, identifies you. It then uses the national ID scheme to figure out who you actually are, and then it docks your social credit score. So your social credit score is a system that's been designed by the Chinese government, and it gives you a rating based on how well behaved you are. Now, the interesting thing with the social credit scoring system is if you drop into the red, you get banned from healthcare, financial services, broadband, high-speed travel, internet, international travel, particular schools. This is already happening. You can go and have a look on Google and other information sources are available. But the interesting thing with the social scoring system is if you are not a good Communist Party player, your score gets docked. So this is why I say it is down to the governments, because while a social credit scoring system is an interesting idea, you know, we don't want people littering or punching people in the street. That's bad. They should probably get punished for that. The concept of actually introducing a political element into the social credit scoring system, that means if you do not support me, my government, my policies, I'm going to ban you from high-speed travel, I'm going to ban your children from going to particular schools. Now we're starting to get into that dystopian state territory.
And by the way, this is 1984 from George Orwell sequel.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I mean, yeah, when you have a look at 1984, as I say, these technologies already exist. I did a keynote on the future of privacy and sort of mix of other bits and bobs. And you'd just be staggered at how much we can tell just from a webcam feed, from your voice. You know, if you're wearing a mask, for example, is a lot of rioters sort of like, you know, and anarchists basically like wearing masks. You know, companies like Facebook can still identify you just from your eyes. So, you know, so everyone basically is running around the streets doing things thinking I'm fine because I'm actually covered in a duvet. We can tell how you're walking. You know, and we can tell it's from you, from how you're walking, you know, so this is kind of NSA, FBI kind of stuff. But this is commercial technology now that's being embedded into really the fabric of our society. But while we have all these technologies to surveil you, to figure out what you're doing online, who you're meeting, I can use GPS on your phones to figure out you're meeting these people and you're probably doing something naughty because this is a naughty person and, you know, you're meeting them. It's down to the government and the government policies that then determine whether or not you live in a dystopia or a utopia. And that's the danger. So as we see deep fakes from, for example, Russia and Eastern Europe increasingly try to undermine Western democracy, the danger is that the people who get into government within the Western democracies are typically dystopian leaning, shall we say. And then you end up in a dystopia. And the greatest thing that you can value, so I travel the world, the greatest thing that people should value is freedom. And it's not easy. It's a sticky, sticky, horrible mess that causes regulators and governments and individuals basically nightmares on a daily basis. But when you go to some of these more authoritarian countries, you can't speak your mind in the same way that you can, for example, in the West. You don't have this, they don't have the same freedoms. And then you are in an Orwellian dystopian novel.
So Matthew, that you paint a picture led by government with people in it. I want to understand your view of that, that picture. I think we automatically think of Earth.
Yeah. Right?
The planet Earth, but yeah. We've been launching things and people into space now, and there are other planets we're exploring, and I'm wondering, what about the environment? Because I want to connect it to the investment that the China's making. Are there investments that we are not making that we need to make rather beyond just innovating to shore up a government and its people.
Absolutely. So, I mean, so when you have a look at the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, there are 17 in all. One of them is partnerships. So really, there are 16, and they deal with everything from future of education and workforce all the way through to equality, water, poverty, energy, that kind of stuff. Climate change, oceans. There's a huge amount, basically, that from a societal perspective that we need to be doing. So the first one, which is sort of one that I kind of try to focus on with the World Futures Forum, basically, is actually trying to balance out inequality. Yeah, we've got the haves and the have-nots. If you have a look at the current space race, that's an ideal example of if you are a billionaire, space is the new billionaire's playground. In fact, I think one of the American papers the other day put it as space is the new billionaire playground because all the billionaires are trying to get off Earth. That's sort of one thing. But when you have a look at, for example, climate change, increasingly, we already have the technology today at a relatively affordable and commercial scale to eliminate over 70% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So we'll break that down. Agriculture accounts for about 20% of all greenhouse gases. Those are typically cows, crops, growing crops to feed to cows, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, land use, deforestation, all that sort of stuff. Vertical farms and clean meat actually take the amount of greenhouse gas emissions down by 99% for the agricultural sector. Next, we have the energy sector, which is about another sort of 15 to 20%. Most of the energy that we use actually goes on heating. We've got zero energy air conditioning systems, courtesy of University of Stanford, or Stanford U. From a renewable energy perspective, we now have 1 trillion watts of energy of renewable energy capacity installed around the world. We need about 6 trillion watts. So we're actually doing all right. And the cost of energy is plummeting as we start pivoting off fossil fuels and oil and gas. When we have a look at transportation, again, another sort of 15 to 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions. We are electrifying our autos and our transportation networks and systems. And again, the innovations that we see in the energy sector actually feed through to the electric vehicle sector. Autonomous vehicles should take about 30% of the traffic off the roads, et cetera. There, even when we have a look at concrete actually accounts for about 5% of all global greenhouse gas emissions, particularly CO2. We actually have new types of green concrete that actually don't use CO2 and don't emit CO2 during the manufacturing process. So we've got, this is just the sort of tip of the iceberg of this conversation, but we've got all these different innovations and technologies and solutions already here to help us decarbonize 70% of all greenhouse gases. So that's kind of climate change. But the problem we have with climate change is that lag. We've got massive ocean acidification. We've got warming oceans. That's going to take a long time to reverse. So frankly, we're in trouble. We're headed to hothouse Earth. I'm sitting here today basically in my 50 degree C studio like you guys are, other than you, Marco. I see you've got some nice air conditioning there. And then when we have a look at sustainability, basically, we've got the circular economy. Adidas basically are sort of doing really well basically on the circular economy, where they've been designing new materials that can be just continuously recycled. We've got biodegradable plastics coming through. There's loads, when you have a look at sustainability as a whole, there are so many different solutions. It's insane. But the reason why we don't appear to be making too much of a difference is because there is a difference between having the technology and the solution available and using and deploying it. And it's that where the lag is, which is where we then get into investment, whether it's private equity, hedge funds, global asset managers, governments, that kind of stuff, or whether it's policy or regulation or whatever it happens to be.
Right. And that's exactly what I was going to say. And that's where we go full circles and we go back into the decision making and how we influence eventually them as a public opinion with knowledge and learning all these things in order to put some pressure on that. We know you have a hard stop. You got present things to worry about. Yeah. And we're gonna let you go with hopefully the idea to get together again, maybe to talk about,
I look forward to it.
Yeah, some other things, and maybe we'll stay more focused. But I think this was a nice overall thought-provoking conversation for our audience, I assume. There will be notes and links and resources on the podcast, so we really hope that everybody enjoyed, that we don't scare you guys too much. It's still up in the air. We're not, you know, we don't know.
We're a good view.
Exactly.
Well, hopefully we still have some control over the future. So.
Exactly. That's the hope. But knowledge is the only way. Matthew, thank you so much. And thank you to the Mentor Project connecting us. And we'll look forward to talk to you again soon.
Well, always a pleasure. That's it. Stay cool. That's it. I can hear the ice cream truck outside, so I know where I'm headed now. It's later. And thanks to everyone.
That's your listening. Future.
Here's Matthew.
Right there. Yeah.
Ice cream truck. Done. That's it in about 5 minutes. Ta-da. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Blue Lava is the first business platform for CISOs to manage their security program. Blue Lava guides security leaders to effectively measure, optimize, and communicate their security program with confidence and ease in one platform. Learn more at bluelava.net.
Nintex is the global standard for business process management and automation. The Nintex platform helps their clients accelerate progress on their digital transformation journeys by quickly and easily managing, automating, and optimizing business processes. Learn more at nintex.com.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.